Are we on?
Hello, my name is Emily Prisco, and you are on the air with GASP. GASP, or the Group Against Smog and Pollution, increases awareness and promotes advocacy around southwestern Pennsylvania's poor air quality. In this episode, we take a walk, a climb, a bike ride, and a bus through Pittsburgh's history right through to the present. We slow things down a little, and we consider the question, how do we envision the future, and what actions do we need to take to get there? Hop on your favorite mode of alternative transportation and join me on the road to a cleaner future. Stay tuned. The United States was built for driving, so it's not really surprising that Americans guzzle 391 million gallons of gasoline every single day. In the process, they pump out greenhouse gases, carbon monoxide, particle pollution, hydrocarbons, nitrogen oxides, sulfur dioxide, and hazardous air toxics. With some of the worst air quality in the country, single passenger vehicles are a particular problem here in the Pittsburgh region. Pollution has been mapped throughout the city, and a lot of it follows major highways and roads, concentrating downtown where traffic is the worst. But there's another growing trend in Pittsburgh, a trend towards alternative transportation. Total vehicle miles traveled has been decreasing for years, and in its place, we've seen Pittsburgh rise to the top 10 of U.S. cities for walking, biking, and public transit commutes. So today, we're taking a step away from polluting vehicles and honoring alternative transportation, beginning in its simplest form, walking. To kick us off, we talked to Lisa Valentino, a woman on a mission to walk every street in Pittsburgh.
So I just started my fourth year, finished 16 neighborhoods, and since I live in Pittsburgh's East End neighborhood, most of the areas between the two rivers are pretty well covered.
When all is said and done, Lisa will have walked over 1,000 miles and seen at least glimpses of almost everything Pittsburgh has to offer. It's a huge endeavor, but Lisa remains undaunted in her determination to walk every single step.
I think in walking, you really get to feel the neighborhood and see the neighborhood. And I love to take photos, and I'm always looking up and down and around the corners, and I just feel like the history is just kind of there pulsating in all of these buildings. Every home, every building, every street has a story. People that have lived in these neighborhoods their entire lives have not ventured off of a main path to discover what's on another street. And that I find really interesting as I'm doing this project. Hopefully, people are encouraged to get out and do that, to go and see what they're missing that's right around the corner from them.
That was Lisa Valentino. You can follow her adventure on Instagram at lisa.valentino or online at lisavcreative.com. Coming up next, we have Laura Zarowski, who has the same goal with a slight twist. So with 45,454 steps, making up 739 sets of stairs, Pittsburgh has more city steps than any other city in the world. Laura's mission? To walk, photograph, and write about every single one of them, using Bob Reagan's book titled Pittsburgh Steps as her field guide.
So when I found this book and I saw in the back it had this big listing.
That's really cool.
And also, like, all of the information in this book about almost all of the 90 neighborhoods have stairs. And I thought to myself, this is a great opportunity for me to really get out and see all of the different neighborhoods, become very familiar with everything, where everything is located, and then at the same time have, like, a really fun and interesting, like, art project, photography mm-hmm. project, writing project, and it'll take me a couple years to do it. So last summer I started, and I just said, you know what, I'm going to start on the very first page of the list, the first row, and just slowly work my way down and work my way through.
A year later, and Laura has made some serious headway. When I contacted her for this interview, Wing Wei was next on the list, and I gladly joined her on the stairs.
And this is where we are right now. We're here on Wadlow Street and Shadeland Ave and also Brighton Road and Wing Wei. After I've spent some time kind of like, you know, hanging around the neighborhood, hanging around the stairs, I usually sit here for a while and, you know, I kind of like look around, take it all in, like see what's the feeling of the neighborhood, what are the sounds, what's kind of happening. Then I sit and I write for a while. And so I also, in my backpack full of materials, in addition to the camera, I also have two notebooks, one that I use just for basic field notes is what I call them, of like, okay, where is it located? Like a lot of illegal dumping here. Uh-huh. Like, oh, is there something really pretty? Is there something really, like something that catches my eye? And so that goes into the field journal. And then I have this regular writing book, which is just kind of where I sit and I just free write for 10 or 15 minutes, kind of based on, you know, different things that I'm thinking about, different things that inspire me. And those are the notes that I take so that, you know, when I'm back at home and I'm packaging everything together to be published on the blog and Instagram, I'm like, okay, I like review all of this and write and edit and write again. And then I publish a story every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
The way she chooses the steps from the back of the book may seem a bit haphazard, but the process she uses when she arrives is anything but. Using her Polaroid Spectra, Laura snaps a single picture of the steps before settling down with her notebooks.
So, what I'm gonna do right now is I'm just gonna settle things down for a bit. Earlier, I took my Polaroid, which is starting to develop.
Yeah.
And get my materials out.
Are those the books?
Yes. And,
while she's waiting for her Polaroid to develop, Laura takes out Bob Reagan's book as a field guide, for my viewing pleasure, and then she disappears behind her notebook. While she writes, I read. Pittsburgh's first mode of mass transportation was our city steps. And I know I've said it before, but I'm just going to repeat it because it's crazy. We have more steps than any other city in the world. 45,454 steps, which make up 739 flights of stairs. And the even crazier thing is that nearly half of these stairs are considered legal streets. So Laura finishes up her writing and I set the book down to be picked up at a later date.
All of these stairs were built at a time when most people didn't have cars. Mm-hmm. If you were fortunate enough to have a car, you had a car, one car, and often, you know, that would be like the dad that would get in the car and like drive off to work someplace, and, you know, mom and the kids would be at home, and all of your shopping was done within your neighborhood, you went to a neighborhood school, you know, your house of worship, whatever your faith was most likely in your neighborhood or very close by. And so people walked the majority of places, and life was just slower. Life was just slower back then. You mean life wasn't easier back then, I don't think by any stretch of the imagination, but many, many more people have cars now than they did back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. And it's just like changing in our priorities. Once someone has a car, that's saying like, oh, do I walk 2 miles so that I can like wait for a bus and then I gotta go up and down all these stairs? You know, I can just get in my car and I can drive and I don't have to shop at the grocery store in my neighborhood because I'm walking there. I can drive across town to go to that other grocery store that I like better. Or, you know, so it's just like once people have, you know, that vehicle at their disposal, it really changes how they interact with everything in their communities. I hope to inspire other people to, you know, to kind of get out and see what these different places are all about. So it's like, even if it's something as, you know, go walk around, like see who lives in your neighborhood, go see those stairs, like see the views. Because yes, it is very easy to just, you know, kind of get in the car and like, you know, drive wherever. But this is more about being a little bit more mindful, just slowing things down, and then also just seeing like, hey, you know, what's around me?
Inspired by Laura's words and eager to learn more about people's relationship to transportation, I geared up with my microphone and biked down to Carson Street for the first open streets of the year.
Oh, I'm Don Sauce out here today for the open streets.
It's one of the best events I think any city could have.
I drove here to park. I was frustrated coming in, and now I'm like walking and happy, and it is a different perspective.
I like it.
This event today was absolutely fantastic. It's always so nice to see so many people outside.
It's a great event, and it shows everyone how easy it is to get around without polluting.
Open streets it's really a magical time to experience streets without cars. It's not a race. It's not a festival. It's simply closing our streets down to cars and opening them up to people to dance, to bike, to walk, to run, to exercise, and to people watch, really. And what ends up happening is that space just fills up with tens of thousands of people, and most of them have smiles on their faces.
Scott Bricker is the co-founder and executive director of Bike Pittsburgh, which is the organization that brought open streets to Pittsburgh.
It originated in Bogota, Colombia in the 1970s. Cool. And so they've been doing it for decades. And now there, they close down about 75 to 80 kilometers of streets every single Sunday and every single holiday. And millions of people participate.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Bogota's open street is the dream. It's run by the government, held weekly, and open to everyone. Bike Pittsburgh organizes and pays for almost everything here, and the relatively small organization is maxed out even as demand for open streets keeps growing.
It addresses so many issues in the city, from public health to air quality to just getting people to meet their neighbors and experience their communities in new ways. And so we're hopeful that one day we can convince the city that just like they put on the Great Race, they should be putting on open streets. We're not there yet. Right now, 3 is all we can really handle on staff. But we've grown it. It's pretty inspiring to see the growth of the event in terms of participation.
Yeah, it's a huge event. It's thousands of people, right?
Yeah. So the first year, over 3 events, we attracted about 45,000. Mm-hmm. And 2 seasons later, we had almost 90,000. So 100% growth rate. We're hoping that's not the case this year. So far, so good. Just because we can't handle that the sheer amount of people. But we already broke our record with the first event.
Since this interview, one more open streets was held. And guess what? It was another record breaker. May's event attracted 36,000 people. June's event attracted 45,000. And Scott seems to think that open streets is really making a difference in how people behave.
Our mission at Bike Pittsburgh is to make the city more bicycle and pedestrian friendly. While we love open streets and those 4 hours changing the entire environment and how people really experience public realm, we want to actually achieve an objective. But we really want to see if it's going to help move the needle on getting people to walk and bike more, whether that's for recreation or transportation. And so we actually do polling at open streets, and we ask these questions. And while this just happened a week and a half ago, and we haven't been able to key in all the data yet, just paging through it before this interview, a significant amount of people are now saying, yeah, I didn't ride, or didn't ride very often, or I didn't walk before open streets, and now I'm thinking about riding more or walking more to work as a result.
That's awesome.
So they're being asked that question, and they're actually saying, like, yeah, I think I will try to work this into my daily routine.
So open streets really seems to be making a difference. But Bike Pittsburgh is an organization with a lofty goal, and it's going to take a lot more than open streets to achieve it.
Bike Pittsburgh is a 16-year-old bicycle and pedestrian advocacy organization, and we concentrate on 3 major things: advocacy, community, and education. And advocacy is really about policy change and infrastructure change. community is about putting on fun events that attract thousands of people, like Open Streets and Pedal Pittsburgh and Bike to Work Day. And then education. So we have some really cool publications. We actually produce the city's bike map. We just came out with the 7th edition last week. We do educational blog posts and videos, and then we actually do in-person trainings. We have an after-school youth program. We have an adult-focused class that we teach the fundamentals and also how to be confident riding your bike in the city. Mm-hmm. So we're doing a lot along all three of those fronts.
So I've experienced Bike Pittsburgh's community and education programs firsthand, and trust me, they're very much worth checking out. You can just ask the tens of thousands of other people who've attended them. But I wanted to know more about the behind-the-scenes advocacy-type work that Bike Pittsburgh is sure will make all the difference for Pittsburgh's growing population of bicyclists and walkers.
So the actual safety of biking in the city is pretty safe. We're one of the safer cities out there, just given the data. The perception of safety is that it's not that safe. There's very few complete networks of very safe and comfortable bicycle infrastructure. And in many communities, there's safe sidewalks that then just end, or they become dilapidated and things like that. So just like it's hard to walk without a complete network of safe pedestrian infrastructure, it's hard to bike without a safe network of bike infrastructure. And we're really concentrating on making biking as intuitive that it is safe, like there are few crashes on that, and also it feels safe, it feels comfortable, you feel like you can bring your kid on that bikeway with you. It's really looking to those cities globally that we're seeing, like 40% of people in Amsterdam ride a bike to work on any given day.
That's crazy. What's that look like here?
In Pittsburgh?
Yeah,
we're about a little over 2.5%.
2.5, okay.
Which is good for an American city. So I know, it's like...
It sounds like a big difference.
Like sad trombone. But at the same time, yeah, we're in the top 10 cities for bike commuting in the United States.
Wow,
out of the top 60 most populated.
Do you know what that number is in terms of walking?
Yeah, I do. So we're in the top 5 for walking commuting.
Oh, that's exciting.
And we're in the top 10 for transit commuting. We actually, for active transportation, Pittsburgh can really like hang with the big kids, you know. And I think that really gets to the heart of how Pittsburgh was built from the beginning. We were built with each neighborhood having a business district for the most part. And we built hundreds of steps to reach those places, and people lived on those hillsides and walked to work. And you know, it's the city's only 54 square miles, pretty small and at one time very dense. It's still respectively dense. Those are the things that get people biking, walking, and taking transit. When those trips are easy, they're short, they're intuitive, they're safe.
What do you see as kind of the way forward for Pittsburgh?
I think it's all about infrastructure. I mean, there's certainly some things that we can do outside of infrastructure. You know, there's educational activities that we take part in. But I've been in enough places, and the people who are biking and walking the most live in places where they've made those investments, where you can like look outside your door and see this street is for cycling. It gets to the grocery store, which is just, you know, blocks away. And it's this sustainable community design model that schools should be within walking distance, grocery stores should be plentiful, and shouldn't have to be 5 to 10 miles away from where you live. And all those services that people need, doctors and dentists and all the things of life, shopping, should be within a 1 to 2 mile distance from where people live. We have to really invest in that framework and invest in things that put biking, walking, and transit first over car infrastructure.
While we are certainly seeing these investments for biking and walking, funding for transit has not been quite as consistent.
There's been some ebbs and flows with the deindustrialization of Pittsburgh and depopulation of Pittsburgh. And then we saw a period between like 2000 and 2011 where our state legislature, which provides most of the funding for transit, really couldn't come to an agreement on funding our transit system properly. Yeah. And so we had a third of our transit lines cut
over that period of time. And then there was another 11% cut that happened in 2011.
That's Laura Weens, the director for Pittsburghers for Public Transit. Her organization is a grassroots effort by transit riders, workers, and residents to defend and expand public transit.
I love being the director for Pittsburghers for Public Transit and public transit in general because it's the perfect marriage of environmental justice, I think civil rights, we think it's a human right issue to be able to access transit, and labor, because we think it's also really important that our drivers are paid well, that they have middle-class jobs with family-sustaining wages and benefits. And for us, there are not many issues that are able to straddle these lines, and I think are things that are so critical to continue investing more in as we try to transition away from fossil fuels and towards climate resilient future.
Pittsburghers for Public Transit arose in 2010 when Pittsburgh's bus system was under attack. But since then, a lot has changed. The organization has seen our transit system begin to recover.
In Pittsburgh, we have 726 buses and we have 83 light rail vehicles, right? Because we have the T mm-hmm. lines. So that's a pretty significant fleet. We're the second biggest agency in Pennsylvania and the 26th largest in the United States.
Wow. That may sound like a lot, and it is, but a lot of the people who saw their bus lines cut are still waiting for the full recovery of our transit system. Buses are important for everyone. And for many, buses are an absolute necessity.
Certainly, they're important for bus riders, for folks that are transit dependent, and that would include people that riders with disabilities, seniors, low-income people, because owning a car is very expensive. On average, it costs something like $8,500 a year. It is also really important in the state of Pennsylvania for undocumented people, because you're not able to get a driver's license if you're undocumented in Pennsylvania. And it's also important for everybody else, because if you have, instead of a bus carrying, you know, 70 people, you have 70 cars on the road, then you can imagine what that does to our air quality, to congestion, to commute times. There's a whole host of other ancillary benefits to people that are not bus riders as well. I mean, we have over 50% of commuters to downtown take the bus, and something like 35 to 40% also take the bus to get to Oakland, which is really significant, right? Mm-hmm. And if we actually took away those buses and had people driving there instead, you can imagine how inaccessible they would then be.
Public buses keep a ton of cars off the road, and they make a big impact in lowering our air pollution. But unfortunately, buses pollute too, and they are mostly impacting the people who are most dependent upon them.
I mean, the regions that have the worst air quality tend to be the highest concentrations of low-income people and communities of color. So I don't think that that's going to be any different for people that are accessing the bus. The ones that are transit dependent, that are at street level, that are waiting outside, are going to be the ones that are going to be most impacted by the emissions and the diesel particulates. There is a good case to be made that there needs to be more bus-only lanes so that they're not sitting in traffic emitting, and that there needs to be the signal prioritization. And these are both amenities that they are proposing with the bus rapid transit between Oakland and downtown, but I think really need to be expanded to encompass a lot more regions, and particularly low-income communities, mm-hmm. Because everyone should have the benefit of faster buses and that are able to take them to their destinations more quickly, but also that they don't have to impact people's air quality and breathing experience in the same way.
The city of Pittsburgh has committed to taking serious steps to address air pollution and climate problems, mostly through the implementation of the Climate Action Plan.
It's important that they put transit as a big piece of the Climate Action Plan. Some of the goals included having bus rapid transit lines, corridors, including the one that they're now proposing between downtown and Oakland, electrification of the fleet, so a fully mm-hmm. electrified bus fleet running only electric vehicles, and doubling of transit ridership, which would by necessity means adding more routes and adding more significant funding.
Our progress in achieving these goals so far has been mixed, but the move towards an electric fleet is one to be excited about. I asked Laura to tell me a little bit more.
There are some obstacles and some challenges for them transitioning to an electric fleet, but they have taken advantage of the federal low no emissions grant this past year, were awarded a $500,000 grant, which they plan to use for 2 battery electric buses. Which is really exciting. And I think with the bus rapid transit project that they're proposing between Oakland and downtown, that would allow them to have the capital money from the federal government to be able to purchase a lot of the electric charging infrastructure and start transitioning more of the fleet on that particular line.
Did you hear that? We have 2 fully electric buses on the way, soon to be roaming the streets of our city. Electric or not, buses are a huge win for the environment. To tell us more about the environment-specific stuff, I am joined by Ashley Deemer of Penn Environment.
Every person who gets out of their single-passenger car and gets on a bus is taking emissions out of the air, right? It's much more efficient to have 40 people commuting on one bus than it is to have 40 cars on the road. So that's clear. But it's also clear that buses that run on diesel, conventional buses that we see every day, are emitting a toxic cocktail of diesel pollutants that are impacting the health of the communities those buses serve and their riders. So buses are great, and we now have the technology to make them cleaner, so there's a little more work to do.
The technology that Ashley is referring to is the electric bus, a subject she is well-versed in after Penn Environment's report on electric buses.
We have 695 conventional diesel buses here in Pittsburgh. We have about 32 hybrid diesel buses, and so far no electric buses. Mm-hmm. I think they're planning to purchase 1 electric bus this year, which is an exciting first step. Mm-hmm. And there are more in the works in the plan for the bus rapid transit system. But what we would like to see is a more systematic commitment to acquiring electric buses over time. We know that transit agencies typically plan to replace a certain percentage of their fleet every year. Mm-hmm. So if you're replacing the buses, why not do electric?
At this point, though, we are replacing most of our old buses with diesel, simply because it's what agencies are most familiar with. But it actually turns out that diesel buses pollute a ton, and they're a lot more expensive to operate in the long run.
It's hard to get big agencies to change, but we know that electric buses actually require less maintenance over time, and they can save an agency money. So over a 10-year life cycle, an electric bus can actually pay for itself.
And that's not even counting the cost of healthcare and the cost to our community that we see from pollution. The level of dangerous pollutants passengers breathe in dramatically increases when they are waiting for a diesel bus, riding on a diesel bus, or driving behind one. By switching over just one bus to electric, the Chicago Transit Authority estimated that the city would save nearly $80,000 a year. $25,000 of that is from saved fuel, but the rest of it all comes from avoided healthcare expenses. $55,000 a year saved by buying just one electric bus. And Chicago isn't the only city ready to make the switch.
Cities are leading the way. Los Angeles has committed to an all-electric fleet. They have 2,300 buses, so they're doing that by 2030. We also know that King County, which serves Seattle, they have committed to acquiring 120 electric buses by 2020. And there are other cities that are testing this, like New York. They have a huge fleet, and they're testing this throughout their different neighborhoods and their different kinds of routes. So it's becoming more and more common, and we know the technology is getting better and better every day.
Here in Pittsburgh, we are patiently awaiting our 2 new electric buses, and we really hope that more will follow. With $2.7 billion pouring in from the Volkswagen settlement agreement and funding sources such as the federal low or no emission, CMAQ, and rebate programs to fund school buses, we know that opportunities to fund electric buses abound.
So there are a lot of great opportunities out there for agencies to supplement the upfront cost. We really just need them to commit, right? So it's all about putting that in your plan, deciding this is a priority. It's about fostering leadership with even elected officials, right? Getting them to say this is important. And that helps educate the public and mobilize parents and even students to call for this as well.
Again, that was Ashley Deemer, the Western Pennsylvania Director of Penn Environment, To learn more about electric transit and school buses, check out the report. It's available online at pennenvironment.org.
Wait, hold on. What's that noise? What is that? I think it's our call to action alert.
Jeez, that alarm is always crazy. So on this episode, we talked about walking and biking and busing. And now that it's all over, we want you to turn this off and get outside. Go support alternative transportation. And if you're a little unsure about how to do that, we have the perfect place for you. Check out this year's final Open Streets on July 28th. It's going to wind all through the East End, and hiding somewhere along the way will be Gasp's Table, surrounded by games and opportunities to get involved. If this doesn't suit you, maybe you're busy, please check out our other guests. There are so many great opportunities to get out of your car and get involved. For more information on the people that you just heard speak, check out our show notes online at gasp-pgh.org. You've been listening to On the Air with Gasp. For this episode, we'd like to thank our guests, Lisa Valentino, Laura Zarowski, Scott Bricker of Bike Pittsburgh, Laura Weens of Pittsburghers for Public Transit, and Ashley Deemer of Penn Environment. We'd also like to thank the community members who spoke with us at May's Open Streets. This podcast is funded by the Colcomb Foundation. Learn more and get notes from this episode at gasp-pgh.org/media. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and review us on iTunes or Stitcher, and stay tuned for our next episode. We'll see you then.